Good evening, everyone. My name is Jessica Callahan, and I'm the chair of the Direction Committee of Tulane University's Campus Programming.
Jessica!
I want to thank you all so much for coming out tonight to our last event of the semester. So far this year, in conjunction with the Freshman Reading Project and the Office for Multicultural Affairs, we've heard from Michelle Alexander on her book, The New Jim Crow. Jackie Summel on her project Herman's House, which aims to end the use of solitary confinement in U.S. prisons, and from Tim Wise on anti-racist activism. Today, Tulane is kicking off our second annual Transgender Week of Awareness, and we continue to commemorate the university's 50th anniversary of desegregation. In the midst of all of this, I'm so excited to introduce tonight's speaker. Through her activism and scholarship over many decades, Angela Davis has been deeply involved in movements for social justice around the world. Her work as an educator, both at the university level and in the larger public sphere, has always emphasized the importance of building communities of struggle for economic, racial, and gender justice. Professor Davis's teaching career has taken her to San Francisco State University, Mills College, and UC Berkeley. She has also taught at UCLA, Vassar, the Claremont Colleges, and Stanford University. Mostly recently, she has spent 15 years at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where she is now Distinguished Professor Emerita of History of Consciousness, an interdisciplinary PhD program, and of Feminist Studies. Angela Davis is the author of 9 books and has lectured throughout the United States, as well as in Europe, Asia, Africa, Australia, and South America. In recent years, a persistent theme of her work has been the range of social problems associated with incarceration and the generalized criminalization of those communities that are most affected by poverty and racial discrimination. She draws upon her own experiences in the early 70s as a person who spent 18 months in jail and on trial after being placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. She also has conducted extensive research on numerous issues related to race, gender, and imprisonment. Her recent books include Abolition Democracy, and Are Prisons Obsolete? About the abolition of the prison industrial complex and a new edition of Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass. In 2012, she published a new collection of essays entitled The Meaning of Freedom. Angela Davis is a founding member of Critical Resistance, a national organization dedicated to the dismantling of the prison industrial complex. Internationally, she is affiliated with, Internationally, she is affiliated with Sisters Inside, an abolitionist organization based in Queensland, Australia, that works in solidarity with women in prison. Like many educators, Professor Davis is especially concerned with the general tendency to devote more resources and attention to the prison system than to the educational institution. Having helped to popularize the notion of a prison industrial complex, she now urges her audiences to think seriously about the future possibility of a world without prisons, and to help forge a 21st century abolitionist movement. Please join me in welcoming Professor Davis.
Thank you so much. Well, thank you for the amazing welcome. It's great to be in New Orleans. We come together this evening on the sesquicentennial anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. On this date, November 19th, 1863, on the battlefield of Gettysburg, as Abraham Lincoln dedicated the Soldiers' National Cemetery, he evoked, and I quote, "The great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead, We take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Well, as you demonstrate, the Gettysburg Address has been well documented through our official historical records. It's probably the most well-known presidential address. But I want to register a call for freedom of a different sort that was made today, exactly 150 years later. On this date, November 19th, 2013, what will hopefully turn out to be a historic music video was released. The title of that music video is We Are America. And it was released today by Esperanza Spalding. And she was assisted by Stevie Wonder and Harry Belafonte and Janelle Monáe and others. And they call for the closing down of Guantanamo Bay Prison. Esperanza Spalding is most known for beating out Justin Bieber and Drake in 2011 for a Grammy for the Best New Artist, right? And I hope she will be best known for taking this courageous stance, calling for a new birth of freedom. So please find the video. You can Google Esperanza Spalding, Guantanamo Bay Prison, and you will find it. And please join the campaign to definitively shut down Guantanamo Bay Prison. It is truly an honor to have been invited to address you here at Tulane University in New Orleans, Louisiana. And I'd like to thank Jessica Callahan and Campus Programming. And I'm especially happy to have been invited to speak on the significance of the multiple freedom anniversaries we are observing during this year, 2013. So I will be speaking about the meaning of freedom in the sesquicentennial year of the Emancipation Proclamation and in the semi-centennial year of pivotal events in the 20th century Black freedom struggles in the US. Of course, I'm not a historian. I'm a philosopher by training, and my work is interdisciplinary, so you will understand why I jump back and forth between multiple historical eras. And so let me tell you a story. Last February, I spoke to a fourth grade class in an elementary school not far away from my house in Oakland, California. I get invited almost every year to come and speak to elementary schools, high schools, universities, during Black History Month. And so, and I say it like that because I'm often introduced as something like a historical artifact. And that was the way I was introduced on that day in before the fourth grade class. So the first thing the children wanted to know was who I had met. And so one said, "Have you ever met Dr. Martin Luther King?" And I said, yes, I actually had the opportunity to meet him on several occasions. Have you met Malcolm X? And I said, yes. I actually met him because he spoke at my university when I was an undergraduate, and there were only about 5 black students on the entire campus, so all of us got to meet him. And then one child asked, have you ever met Harriet Tubman? And I said, no. And I said, does anybody know why I could not have met her? And a young boy, raised his hand and he said, because she died in 1913. And I said, I was impressed. And I was a little bit more impressed than the previous time I had spoken at that elementary school, because after speaking about slavery, a young boy asked me whether I had been a slave. Now, my first impression was that these questions were indicative of a fundamental lack of historical education. And that may very well have been the case, but then it occurred to me that there may have been a kernel of truth in those children's questions. Because we inhabit our histories, we live inside our histories, and our histories inhabit us, even when we do not realize it. So, actually, I could have said, yes, I met Harriet Tubman, and since I directly benefited from her work as an Underground Railroad conductor and as a Civil War soldier and spy, you might also say that I was a slave. And of course, I supported her 30-year-long struggle to get a soldier's pension. As far as centennials go, we might recognize that Harriet Tubman died on March 5th, 1913, as the young boy in the class noted. And one might say that she lived just long enough to pass on her militant spirit to the next generation in the person of Rosa Parks, who was born on February 4th, 1913. 50 years later, in 1963, W.E.B. Du Bois passed away. And of course, there are many semi-centennials, from the March on Washington and the letter to a Birmingham jail to the Birmingham Children's Crusade and the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church that claimed the lives of Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wesley, Addie Mae Collins, and Denise McNair. And of course, during that year, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy took place. But here we are in the state of Louisiana, the prison capital of the world. And I would like to hope, actually, that we remember this year, the year 2013, as the year of Herman Wallace. And as you know, Herman spent over 40 years in solitary confinement in Angola prison. And when his conviction was finally overturned, leading to his release on October 1st of this year, he was only able to experience 3 days of freedom. He died on October 4th. Herman Wallace, former member of the Black Panther Party, was a prisoner of the state that now ranks number one in the nation in terms of its incarcerated population. The United States can claim 25% of the world's prison population, both proportionately and absolutely more than any other country in the world. Louisiana claims the highest percentage of incarcerated people in relation to its population than any other state in the nation. And I learned reading a series that appeared in the Times-Picayune on, I think it was called Louisiana Incarcerated. I learned that one out of every 86 adult people in the state is doing time. And that if you take this city, New Orleans, post-Katrina, New Orleans, among black men in this city, one out of every 14 is behind bars, but one out of every 7 is either in prison, on parole, or on probation. Now, I understand that many of you here this evening had the opportunity to hear legal scholar, activist, Michelle Alexander, am I right? And artist, Jackie Sumel, who created the art installation about Herman Wallace. And that was an amazing project. What kind of a house does a man who has spent decades in solitary confinement dream of inhabiting? And Michelle Wallace, of course, has pointed out that today there are more black men in prison and under the direct control of a criminal justice agency than there were enslaved in this country in 1850. Take note of that. Remember that. Because that will help us answer the question, how far have we come since the Emancipation Proclamation? How far have we come since the 1963 Birmingham campaign of the civil rights movement? We are observing the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail, in which he defended his right to organize in Birmingham, where, of course, he was accused of being an outside agitator in this way. I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and nations. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to injustice everywhere. We are caught, he wrote, in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. We're also observing the 50th anniversary year of the Birmingham Children's Crusade. How many of you are familiar with the Birmingham Children's Crusade? Good, but everybody should be aware of it. In May 1963, vast numbers of school children, children from elementary schools and high schools, faced Bull Connor's police dogs and the high power fire hoses. And it was their televised demonstrations that revealed to the world the determination with which Black people continued to struggle for freedom. And we know that 1963 was also the year of the March on Washington, the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom that was attended by 250,000 people. And at that time, this was the largest human assembly in Washington ever. The largest ever human assembly in Washington. Now, last August, two commemorative marches took place, one of which was addressed by Presidents Obama and Clinton, and the other was addressed by Reverend Al Sharpton. If I had time, I would talk about those marches. People were kind of confused, like, which march do I go to if I want to commemorate the March on Washington? But as it turned out, there was another question, which march should I go to if I want to continue being involved in the struggle for freedom? And I don't know whether either march actually satisfied the desires of those who wanted to continue the legacy of those who marched in 1963. Now, in Birmingham, Alabama, in September 15th, a whole number of events took place in observance of the 50th anniversary of the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church and the killing of four young Black girls. And what is often left out is that another girl was severely wounded, Sarah Collins, the sister of Addie Mae Collins. She lost an eye in that bombing and was not only never acknowledged for her suffering, but she never received any assistance from the city or the state or the nation for her medical bills. And there were also two young Black men who were killed on that day in the community in Birmingham. One was killed by the police and one was killed by a group of white boys who were driving through a Black neighborhood randomly shooting and hurling racist epithets. But the highlight of the observances in September 2013, 2 months ago, was the bestowal of the highest civilian honor on the families of the girls who were killed. The Congressional Gold Medal is the highest civilian honor. And I thought that that was good. But what I fear about such observances is that they can tend to enact historical closures. They represent the events they commemorate as historical moments along a trajectory that leads to an ultimately triumphant democracy, a democracy which can be displayed as a model for the world, one which can also serve as justification for military incursions around the world, including the increased use of drones in the so-called war on terror that has resulted in the killing of vast numbers of people, especially now in Pakistan. No one can deny that global popular culture is saturated with references to the 20th century freedom movement. We know that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is one of the most widely known historical figures in the world. In the US, as a matter of fact, there are more than 900 streets named after Dr. King. In 40 states, including this state, in Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico. But it has been suggested by geographers who have studied these naming practices that they have sometimes been used in order to deflect attention from persisting social problems such as the lack of education and housing and jobs and the use of carceral strategies to conceal the continued presence of these problems. And you have an MLK Boulevard right here in New Orleans, don't you? And I read that last January 21st, which was MLK Day, 5 people were shot on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. Well, there are more than 900 streets named after Dr. King, but there are 2.5 million people in U.S. jails and prisons and youth facilities and immigrant detention facilities and military prisons and jails in Indian country. And that is the census of only one day. These millions of bodies, mostly black and brown, but also poor and white, serve as fodder for a vast prison industrial complex with global dimensions that profits from strategies designed to hide social problems that have remained unaddressed since the era of slavery. So there is simultaneously what you might call a saturated geographical presence of the culture of the Black Freedom Movement, and the lack of anything other than abstract knowledge about that movement, especially a lack of popular knowledge that would help us cultivate more complicated ideas about the geographies and temporalities of freedom movements. And so how can we counteract the representation of historical agents as powerful male individuals? In order to reveal the part played, for example, by black women domestic workers in the Black Freedom Movement. Regimes of racial segregation were not disestablished primarily because of the work of great leaders and presidents and legislators, but because of the fact that ordinary people adopted a critical stance in the way they perceived their relationship to reality. Social realities that might have appeared inalterable, impenetrable, came to be viewed as malleable, transformable, and people learned how to imagine what it might mean to live in a world that was not exclusively governed by the principle of white supremacy. This collective consciousness of ordinary people emerged within the context of social struggles. And that is the significance of these semi-centennial anniversaries we observe. Orlando Patterson, who is the author of the book Slavery and Social Death, has argued that the very concept of freedom, which has inspired world revolutions, 1776, the American Revolution, 1789, the French Revolution, that this concept of freedom must have been first imagined by slaves. And as a matter of fact, as much as your history books tell you about the French Revolution and the American Revolution, what is erased from the historical record is the significance of the Haitian Revolution. because as history witnessed the emergence of new democracies, the birth of freedom, to which Abraham Lincoln made reference in the Gettysburg Address, a new birth of freedom, they've failed to acknowledge that there was only one place in the world where there was a democracy that was not racialized, a democracy that was available to all, and that was in Haiti. So remember that. During the era of the 20th century Black Freedom Movement, the human beings whose predicament most approximated that of the slaves from whom they were descended were Black women domestic workers. In the 1950s, some 90% of Black women who worked, and all Black women worked, some 90% were domestic workers. And as a matter of fact, I could tell you the story of my own mother, who did domestic work in order to pay her rent at the YWCA in Birmingham, Alabama, where she had run away from home so she could get an education, and this was in order to go to high school. 90% of Black women were domestic workers. So when you think about the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955, who do you imagine were the people who rode those buses? It was mostly Black women. And who were the people who refused to ride the buses? Poor Black women. Black women who were maids and cooks and washerwomen, and Black women who took care of white people's children. And why is it so difficult to acknowledge what must have been among these poor Black women, this wondrous collective imagination of a future world without racial and gender and economic oppression? But of course, we think that it was Dr. Martin Luther King who created the Montgomery bus boycott. And then, of course, there's Fannie Lou Hamer, a sharecropper and a domestic worker who was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and a leader of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, who said, "All my life I have been sick and tired, and now I am sick and tired of being sick and tired." So in 1964, she achieved national prominence when she demanded that members of her Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party be seated at the National Democratic Party Convention. And so she paved the way for the election of Barack Obama in multiple ways. Without Fannie Lou Hamer, there could not have been a Barack Obama. Now, this is the 50th anniversary of so many pivotal moments in what we know as the Civil Rights Movement. But it is also the sesquicentennial of the Emancipation Proclamation. And let me say that the historical significance of the Emancipation Proclamation is not so much that it enacted the emancipation of people of African descent. On the contrary, the Emancipation Proclamation was a military strategy. And if you look at the text, you will discover that more space is devoted to the exceptions, that is to say, to those slaves who would not be emancipated, you know, than to the fact of emancipation itself. If we grasp the meaning of that historical moment, it seems to me we might better be able to understand the failures as well as the successes of emancipation. We might better be able to understand what I would call the dialectics of emancipation. And of course, we still live with the popular myth that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, which continues to be perpetrated in popular culture and even by the film Lincoln, which is, of course, about the effort to get the 13th Amendment passed. We also live with the myth that the 20th century civil rights movement freed the second class citizens. Now, civil rights are very important. They constitute an essential element of the freedom we then demanded, but it was not the whole story. And all of these narratives about somebody freeing the slaves, whether Abraham Lincoln freeing the slaves, they erase the agency of black people themselves. But if there's one thing about Lincoln that can be applauded, it is that Abraham Lincoln was shrewd enough to know that the only hope of winning the Civil War resided in creating the opportunity for black people to fight for their own freedom. And that was the significance of the Emancipation Proclamation. Most of you have probably seen the film Lincoln, right? No?
No.
Well, you should see it. But if you see it, don't get to the theater late, because the most important scene comes during the first couple of minutes. So if you walk in 5 minutes late, you will have missed the most important scene of the entire film. And that scene has, first of all, a white soldier is trying to recite the Gettysburg Address, and he kind of stammers and forgets the last part of it. So it is the black soldier who has really memorized it, so that when the white soldier stammers, the black soldier confidently recites it to the end. Now, never mind that this could not possibly have happened, because the means of communication, you know, they didn't have ways of transcribing and communicating speeches like, you know, now all we have to do is, look up on the internet Barack Obama said yesterday, and we'll find it. But nonetheless, it was important. And what was important was that the black soldier emphasizes the pivotal role that black people played in the war. And this is especially important now in light of the fact, as we commemorate the sesquicentennial of the Gettysburg Address, not a single black soldier was buried in the cemetery that was inaugurated by the Gettysburg Address. W.E.B. Du Bois, in chapter 4 of his book, Black Reconstruction, and I hope many of you have read Black Reconstruction. I see some heads shaking. How many of you have actually read it? Okay. I wish 20 times as many people had read it. It is perhaps the single most important text about U.S. history. So tell your history professors, or if your history professors are not receptive, read it anyway. In chapter 4 of Black Reconstruction, Du Bois describes the slaves who join the Union Army, which ultimately made it possible for the Union to be victorious and ultimately paved the way for the nation we know today. Du Bois describes them as strikers. He called them an army of striking labor. And maybe because he uses Marxist terminology, maybe that's why you don't know the book. Because what he said was that black people decided to go on strike against the slaveholders and transfer their labor from the plantations and the farms and the houses to the Union Army. And he said that this army of striking labor eventually provided the 200,000 soldiers, quote, whose evident ability to fight decided the war. And they were not all men. There were women as well. As a matter of fact, I earlier evoked Harriet Tubman, who was a soldier and a spy for the Union Army. But when the war was over, they refused to give her a soldier's pension. And she fought for 3 decades until she finally received her soldier's pension. One of the most hidden eras of U.S. history is the period of radical reconstruction. And that is the period following the end of the Civil War. It's certainly the most radical period in the history of this country, where black people were elected to office, where there was a campaign for public education. And as a matter of fact, many people to this day are not aware of the extent to which that campaign for public education waged by former slaves brought education to the children of white poor people who otherwise never had the opportunity to go to school. And I think that's a lesson for New Orleans today, too. Especially given the fact that the teachers of this city, that all of the teachers were fired, right? I mean, have you ever heard of such a thing? Some 7,500 teachers, the majority of whom were black, and they've been replaced by a majority of out-of-town teachers in a setting of privatized schools. This is a prime example of what Naomi Klein has called disaster capitalism. Disaster capitalism. Private schools, and don't let me get started talking about the private prisons in this state. But I was talking about radical reconstruction and the creation of public education, the creation of what we now call HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. And the economic development that took place within that period. But of course, in 1877, radical reconstruction was overturned. And it was not only overturned, it was also erased from the historical record. And therefore, in the 1960s, we confronted issues that should have been resolved in the 1860s. And as a matter of fact, the KKK and the racial segregation that was so dramatically challenged during the era of the 60s was produced not during slavery, but in the aftermath of slavery in an attempt to manage free black people who otherwise would have been far more successful in pushing for democracy for all people in this country. And so the failure of radical reconstruction was not simply the failure to incorporate former slaves into society, it was a fundamental failure of democracy. It was an attempt to thwart the promise of democracy that the struggles of black people represented. And so we can talk about the dialectical development of the black liberation movement. And everyone refers to the 60s as the civil rights movement, right? And at the time, we called it the freedom movement. There's been an attempt to co-opt that movement and to squeeze it in to a much smaller frame, the frame of civil rights. This, of course, is not to say that civil rights is not immensely important, but freedom is still more expansive than civil rights. And as that movement grew and developed, it was inspired by, and in turn inspired, liberation struggles in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, in Australia. And so it was not only a question of acquiring the formal rights to fully participate in society, but rather it was also about the 40 acres and a mule that dropped out of the abolitionist agenda in the 19th century. It was also about free education and free health care and affordable housing. And it was also about ending the racist police occupation of black communities. And so, in the 1960s, organizations like the Black Panther Party were created. And if one looks at the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party, you see demands for, number one, freedom, number two, full employment, number three, an end to the robbery by the capitalists of our black and oppressed communities, number four, decent housing, fit for the shelter of human beings, number five, education, decent education for our people that exposes the true nature of this decadent American society. We want education that teaches us our true history and our role in the present day society. Number six, we want completely free health care for all black and oppressed people. Number seven, we want an immediate end to police brutality and the murder of black people, other people of color, all oppressed people inside the United States. Number eight, we want an immediate end to all wars of aggression. Number nine, we want freedom for all black and oppressed people now held in US federal, state, county, city, and military prisons and jails. We want trials by a jury of peers for all persons charged with so-called crimes under the laws of this country. And then number 10, we want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, peace, and people's community control of modern technology. Now, this program recapitulated abolitionist agendas of the 19th century, and it continues to resonate in the 21st century. Interestingly, the Black Panther Party was founded in 1966, so 3 years from now, will we be observing the 50th anniversary of the Black Panther Party? Well, you know, let me say that some movements can be represented as having already achieved their goals, and those are the movements that are written in to the narrative of the struggle for democracy in this country. Those whose agendas continue to resonate today are marginalized. So why don't we ask President Obama whether there will be official observances of the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party. But let me, I know I have to wind up because I'm running out of time. And
now just keep going, you're good.
Okay. Well, I spoke about Herman Wallace, who of course was a member of the Black Panther Party. I also want to evoke other members of the Black Panther Party, Mir Abu-Jamal, whose freedom we should continue to demand, Assata Shakur, who received asylum in Cuba after escaping from a U.S. prison many, many years ago. She was just recently designated at the age of 66, one of the 10 most dangerous terrorists in the world. Now that should tell you something about the function of the ideological category of terrorism. Because I want to know why it is never acknowledged that the white supremacists who planted bombs that destroyed lives and homes and churches are never referred to as terrorists. If you want to talk about terrorism, look at the history of this country, and until we face the fact that our history is saturated with terrorism, we will never be able to resolve the problem of racism in the U.S. And so acknowledging continuities between 19th century anti-slavery struggles, 20th century civil rights struggles, and 21st century abolitionist struggles requires a challenge to the closures that isolate the freedom movement of the mid-20th century from the century preceding and the century following. But it is incumbent upon us not only to recognize these temporal continuities, but also to recognize horizontal continuities, links with a whole range of social movement struggles today. And of course, we need to point to the ever more influential movement to abolish prisons and the entire prison industrial complex. So this means that we have to stop referring to movements in defense of prisoners' rights as prison reform. We always talk about prison reform, don't we? But prison reform is partially responsible for the state of prisons today, because prison reform has been happening as long as there have been prisons in this country. And that is to say, since the era of approximately the American Revolution. So, prison abolition, not prison reform. Abolish prisons. Abolish the structures of racism that have fuel the highly profitable prison industry. Abolish the sexism that is at the core of the prison industry, as well as the homophobia and transphobia that is regularly reanimated by the prison industry.
And I understand that in this city, one of the most important social movement struggles today, and this is true for the entire country, is the fight for immigrant rights. New Orleans, of course, New Orleans is an especially important arena for this struggle, given the significant numbers of immigrants who assisted in the post-Katrina recovery work. And I understand that now ICE conducts regular raids in New Orleans, and that recently there was a protest here against ICE raids. And I understand that immigrant workers won a victory against Sheriff Guzman of the Orleans Parish Prison, and they won an agreement that the jail would no longer cooperate with ICE holds. And this is the first southern city to do this. Before I conclude, I want to specifically mention connections across national borders. And I want to mention the ongoing struggles in Palestine, where not too long ago, Palestinian freedom riders, following the example of US freedom riders in 1961, set out to contest the apartheid practices on the part of the State of Israel. And so I want to emphasize the connections between our struggles here and the struggles of our Palestinian sisters and brothers. Palestinians and Israel are subject to the technologies that are controlled by transnational corporations, and specifically, I will name one, the largest security company in the world, G4S. G4S, which has a subsidiary in the US called G4S Secure Solutions. And that company has offices all over the country, including right here in New Orleans. It owns and operates juvenile facilities. And I could go on and I could tell you about the fact that, G4S, which owns and operates prisons and all kinds of security agencies and services all over the world, is the third largest private corporation in the world. What is the first largest private corporation? Well, you should know. Walmart. Walmart is the world's largest private corporation. The second one is Foxconn. And the third one is G4S. And I could tell you a lot about G4S, but that would be the beginning of another talk, which I will have to wait, maybe another time. So let me conclude by emphasizing the importance of comprehending intersections and connections. And feminism urges us to grasp these connections of phenomena that often appear to have little to do with each other, but we realize that they are very much related. These intersections and connections across time and space that bring us all together to constitute a powerful and vibrant community of resistance dedicated to an indivisible struggle for freedom. And so in conclusion, in the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Thank you very much.
Jessica?
Yes, we have time for a few questions.
Okay.
We have time for a few questions, and afterwards we'll move into the book signing. So if you could just keep them brief, we'd really appreciate it.
Okay, a few brief questions before we conclude. Okay, can you be heard? I'm sorry, if you come down and come to the microphone, I can't hear what you're saying. I apologize.
Excuse me, I'm sorry for not being as well-versed as you, but who pays for free healthcare?
Who pays for free healthcare?
Yeah, with your...
Well, let me ask you something. Do you pay taxes?
Yes, but...
So what if those taxes weren't used to fund military incursions? Suppose we... Suppose we shut down the Pentagon.
I mean, I understand that, but like, if, I don't know, for me, my doctor bill is $300 because I have a common cold.
I'm sorry, I can't hear what you're saying.
My doctor bill, when I go to the doctor for my common cold, it's $300. So the idea of the government paying $300 for already overinflated health care.
Well, it's, okay.
Sorry.
That's ridiculous. That is absolutely ridiculous, and you admit it, right? So it's not a question of keeping the healthcare system that we have today and finding somebody to pay for it. It's a question of transforming the very structure of human services. And, you know, I happen to believe that by virtue of the fact that we are human beings, we deserve education, we deserve healthcare, we deserve housing. And unfortunately, because of the dismantling of the socialist nations, and of course there were major problems with the Soviet Union and other socialist countries, but don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Because it was demonstrated that it is possible to have free education and free health care and affordable housing and free child care. There are a country like Cuba continues to provide health care, education, housing, etc. But thank you. I really appreciate the question. And let me say that people who aren't quite as old as I am, and who haven't been around as long as I've been around, maybe don't remember that healthcare used to be much more available to everyone before the rise of the HMOs and before the wholesale privatization of healthcare.
Hi, Ms. Davis. I was just curious as to what was your like individual reason for joining the movement? What got you to that point?
Let me see if I can know. Okay, that works. Sorry. That's kind of heavy. you know, I didn't get to have a reason. I really didn't get to have a reason for becoming involved in the movement. It was a question of survival. I grew up in what was the most segregated city in the country, in Birmingham, Alabama. I often tell the story that, you know, I was a very impatient child, and I couldn't understand why I couldn't do the things I wanted to do, and why I couldn't go to the museum or to the library.
And my mother always said to me, she said, this is not the way things are supposed to be. And so she gave me that gift of being able to imagine a very different kind of future. And so I used to say that my first involvement with the movement was in when I was 11 years old, when I joined an interracial discussion group, and the church where we were holding our meetings was bombed. And see, you don't know about all the other bombings. The 16th Street Baptist Church was just one bombing out of many. But then, just recently, I realized that I would have been involved in the movement since I was maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 years old. And I was thinking about a game we used to play. My family lived on the edge of a neighborhood that was zoned for black people, so white people lived across the street, mm-hmm. So it was illegal for us to walk across the street, literally. And so we used to play games in which we dared each other to run across the street. And the ones who really prevailed were those who were bold enough to run across the street, run up the steps of some white person's house and ring the doorbell and get back to safety before the white person came. You know, so I think it's just the way I learned how to live my life. It's has never been a question for me. And I think that that when one sees it as something that's not extraordinary, it's not based on an extraordinary decision. It's just about a way in which one lives, respecting human equality and justice. And so, you know, one can be in the movement in all kinds of ways. So I think it's important to demystify the notion that one has to be a certain way in order to be an activist. Esperanza Spalding is a great activist, even though I don't think people would have called her an activist. But the fact that she's using her music to get this message out to people to close down Guantanamo, so use whatever talents you have. Do it in whatever way you find most closest to your heart. And thank you for the question.
Good evening, sister. Greetings from your comrades.
Good evening.
I got you by a couple of minutes. You didn't mention tonight, but I want you to add this to your repertoire. The United Nations just left a court in Louisiana saying that my brother, Wood Fox, who has been in one of the Angola Three, is still incarcerated. We thought by him coming out of Angola, it would be a little different, but doing strip searches on him all day long. I don't mean to take your time, but when the world is telling us how inhumane we are, if you don't mind, we'd appreciate it if you would add that. And tonight you took me on a roller coaster through my life, and like I told the baby in front of you, you didn't have to have a reason, we lived it. Be blessed.
Well, thank you, thank you. I mean, you're absolutely right. I should have mentioned Albert Wood Fox and his initially successful effort to end strip searching. And let me say that strip searching and cavity searching is not just a regime that happens in prison. It's like sexual assault. And I think we should call it sexual assault. And by looking at that, we then recognize that there's a connection between the institution and the personal, between the political and the personal, between the institutional and the intimate. So I thank you so much. There's so much I should have mentioned. I also should have mentioned Leonard Peltier and the fact that he's the longest held political prisoner in this country. But thank you very much for reminding me that we are here in
in Louisiana.
Okay, well, first I wanted to say thanks for coming. Like, I didn't know I would be able to ever meet you, for real. And then it was a free event, and it was, like, perfect. Okay. So, had to throw that out there. Okay, so I didn't know if you were going to leave already. I don't have any, like, a reason to start the movement or anything. But I just want to know if you could just give me, like, 3 books to read. I haven't actually recorded, like, the whole thing.
I preach.
But, like, if you could just give me, like, 2 books.
Oh, I know about her book.
But, like, books that,
Okay, well, have you read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow?
I have that on the list, yeah.
Okay, well, that's a good book to read. Oh, my God, what else? Anybody have any? I mean, there's so many.
Well, I wanted...
What?
Read her books. Listen to her lecture. They're on Google and YouTube.
Well, you know something? I just finished a really amazing short story, because I think that a reading habit should be more eclectic than they usually are. So I just read this wonderful short story by Chimamanda Adichie, who is a Nigerian writer. And it's in a collection. The name of the story is Cell Number 1, I think. And it's in a collection that is called The Thing Around My Neck. The Thing Around My Neck. And her most recent novel is called Americana, N-A-H, which is also, yeah, as a matter of fact, that's a great book to read, because it's a novel. But the main character becomes a blogger, and she blogs on race as seen from the perspective of an outsider, because she said she only became black when she came to this country, because she wasn't considered black. Everybody's black in Nigeria, so nobody has to call themselves black. So that's a really wonderful, wonderful book. The first short story is about being in prison. The second is about the experience of race in America.
Hello, Professor Davis. My name is Devon Pruitt, and I'm a student at Xavier University up the street. And my question may seem a little elementary, but I was just curious. Recently, my car was broken into, so I was all like, whoever this is, they need justice, lock them up or what have you. And to come here and hear your lecture about abolished prisons, I'm like, okay. So my question for you is, what are some solutions or if prisons were abolished, how would we as a society control crime if people commit crime? Like, what are your solutions or things?
Okay, let me see if I can answer that question. And there's a long, long line there. So you just ask a big, big question. But let me see if I can be succinct. Why don't you wait? Because I'd like to talk to you. Okay. Okay. So it's oh, you're coming up close. Okay. So, first of all, if we see the function of prisons as not being primarily to prevent crime, as a matter of fact, it's not really about crime. Let me just give you an example of what I mean. The massive prison population has been in part fueled by the so-called drug wars, right? Now, why is it that almost all of the people who end up going to prison on drug charges are black or Latino? When, if you look at drug use and drug trafficking, there's no difference in the rate of drug consumption and drug trafficking between black and Latino on the one hand, and white communities. So why is it that the white kids who do drugs and sell drugs don't end up in prison? You know? I mean, they're doing the same thing. And oftentimes they're committing the same kinds of criminal acts. But they don't live in communities that are subject to hyper-surveillance.
Okay.
Hyper-surveillance. So it's where law enforcement is, where the cops are, that's where the people are going to come from that go to a prison. If you look at any, I mean, I just went to, I was just in Iowa. And, you know, places like Iowa that have like, I don't know, 2% black population, you go into their prisons and their prisons have this hugely disproportionate number of black people. So, I mean, I'm not saying that people don't commit acts of harm. They don't harm property. They don't harm human beings. But the prison is not designed to prevent that. It's not designed to keep us safer. We only think it's about security. We only think it's about safety. But actually, it is about managing bodies, managing black bodies, Latino bodies, poor white bodies that don't have the opportunity to get an education, that don't have the opportunity to have decent housing or health care. So for me, the alternative is housing, education, health care, all of that. And all I'm saying is that we have to be able to dream. We cannot allow our dreams to be restricted by these notions of the way things should be. And people assume that just because prisons are here, they're gonna stay. And that's the only way we can deal with the issues of harm. And let me just give you one example of why they don't work that should actually tell us that there's something severely wrong with the way we approach violence and harm. I can remember when violence against women was not a crime. When the cops would be called it and they would say, oh, is this a domestic disturbance? So if a woman was being beaten by a male partner and the cops came, they would say, oh, this is not something that the police should deal with. It's okay. Today, that's no longer the case. Vast numbers of people, men, a few women, go to prison for violence against women all over the world. But if you look at the incidence of violence against women, it remains the same. Putting people in prison does not solve the problem. And as a matter of fact, it often complicates the problem. It often, the person who goes to prison as a result of committing act of violence against women is gonna be in a violent setting, and when he comes out, he's probably gonna be much more violent than when he went in. So I'm talking about imagining a completely different kind of society. It's not just get rid of the prisons and leave everything else the way it is. We have to reform the society. Okay.
Good evening, Angela. It's such an honor to be able to hear you speak tonight. I have to say that after Katrina, I was stuck in Memphis for a year and I re-educated myself there, and part of my re-education was reading and listening to a number of lectures and books that you've written. So I'm a human rights activist, meaning I advocate for everything that a human has a right to. And I love what you said about zoning. Zoning precedes a lot of gentrification that happens around this country. And I would encourage anybody listening tonight to participate in the City Planning Commission, have the zoning ordinance, zoning ordinance draft, which you can comment on up till November 30th. Please pay attention to that. If you have any doubt, look at what happened in Brooklyn with the gentrification of Brooklyn. It all began with the zoning. So, and also with the prison industrial complex, I'm advocating right now for a mental health facility to try to redirect patients from the prison, mentally ill from the prisons to hospitals as a result of Ronald Reagan's getting rid of the Mental Health Care Act. Funding all goes to the corrections facilities now and nothing to the hospitals. So, but my question to you is, also part of the New Orleans Cooperative Development Project, you know, there's an initiative by the city and numerous organizations to get people jobs in this city and this country where they'll be making a minimum wage of, if the president passes a minimum wage of $9 to $10 an hour. It's not a living wage. So cooperatives are an alternative to working dead-end jobs. Do you have any experience with cooperatives? And if so, do you have any advice to me?
Well, yeah, I think our cooperatives are really important. And there are many examples where around the world where workers have taken over factories that were shutting down and have turned them into a cooperative. I went to a high school many years ago in New York that was a cooperative. Because it was a progressive high school, public high school, and then New York decided to shut it down, and the teachers decided to buy the school, and it became a cooperative owned and operated by the teachers. Thank you very much for your question. Okay, we just, how much more time do we have? Okay.
Very quick, Mrs. Davis. You got me. Through high school and a halfway across the country. I didn't make it to UCLA, but I made it here to Loyola and Xavier, freshman, sophomore year there. You talk about Mr. Gusman, and the last time he was here in town and you toured the Ninth Ward, I had just gotten out of jail for criminal trespassing. Up until that time, I had managed to stay in New Orleans from 1974 without having a real serious contact with the police department. But following Katrina, we had to be documented as to who we were and where we were. They wanted to know that. I went to jail for criminal trespassing. I think I was standing by a bus stop at the Shell station in my neighborhood, and they just rounded up us all up. My teeth were knocked out, one, by a heroin addict who wanted to move to the next level. Okay, when you talked about Mr. Gusman, how much do you know about his background? I think he's a reformer. He was the COA for several of our mayors. But I want you to know this. This is what the boys see when they get out of jail. These are energy drinks. Cocaine. It plants Herbert Marcuse back at Brandeis. Repetitious behavior. Planning the message. I studied advertising across the street at Loyola with an Italian professor, University of Rome, a PhD in philosophy. My college roommate just came back from Kenya. He's doing work for the Catholic Church. He's in China now. How do we deal with this? Because I went in the store and bought this, and now it's probably not going to be very good for me. The Arabs across the street from my house.
You know, I think that's a really good point that you make. And had I been able to speak for several hours before you, I would have talked about the connections with the food justice movement, because I think that is one of the most important social movements. So many people in this country are not aware of the fact that the food they consume is killing them. And it is largely by virtue of the fact that it is subject to the same kinds of capitalist production as the privatization of healthcare or the privatization of schools or the privatization of
of prisons, it's about making money. And so how are we going to rise up against Monsanto, for example? And I think, you know, I think the food justice movement is very much connected to developing a different kind of respect for the beings that cohabit this planet. So it's not just about, we talk about human rights, but it's not just about human beings. It's about other animals. It's about, you know, all of the things that grow on this planet. So thank you very much for your question.
I have a very simple question. I would love to get an answer from a philosopher like you. I just want to know, what is love?
And when you asked that question, you knew that it was not a very simple question. But I will answer that by paraphrasing something that Che Guevara said many, many years ago. And he said, all great revolutionaries are motivated by feelings of love. And one more question, right?
Yes. Hello, how you doing? My name is Henry James.
Woo!
I'm one of the oldest inmates, oldest individual that did 30 years wrongfully, been convicted, was convicted, did 30 years. In the state of Louisiana, one of the oldest inmates that did the most time in the state of Louisiana. I was exonerated through DNA.
Okay, I was through the Innocence Project.
That's right.
Well, I am so honored to meet you, and I think you should all rise. So, did you have a question too?
Yeah, what is justice? Why can I receive justice? Because, you know,
it's not justice. You're absolutely right. It's not justice.
I mean, in Louisiana, in the law system here in Louisiana, it's no such thing as what I experienced. It's no justice in here or no different when you're being in prison. And because how can you, I'm gonna give you a prime example of my situation. This is all right. Can I share it briefly? The description that was given to the individual that was accused of coming was a chubby guy, weighed 165 pounds. But here I'm weighing 147 pounds because of black and white crime. How can you get a chubby man mixed up with a slender built man? And here you got a mugshot with me right there in your face, but they still won't let me go.
Well, you know, there are so many stories behind the so-called convictions of so many people. I can tell you that when I was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, hundreds and hundreds of black women were arrested, many of whom looked absolutely nothing like me. So it's not even about the assumption of similarity. It's about a way that racism functions. Racism functions to create a kind of interchangeability among individuals. So if you can't get one, at least get somebody. Right. And as long as that somebody is of the same racial background. Right. I mean, this is what happened with lynchings. This is what has plagued the criminal justice system for I don't know how long.
Well, how do we stop it?
Well,
I'll slow it down at least.
Well,
I'll get some type of way at least a little fair chance at
well,
justice.
Well, see, I think
we're not getting it here in Louisiana.
I think abolitionism is a way to begin. When
that's what I'm looking for.
Because see, it's not just about, and I'm so glad that you are free, my brother. I am so glad that you are free.
Thank you.
But I can also tell you the story of my co-defendant, Rochelle McGee, who, speaking about 50th anniversaries, he has been in prison for 50 years. He was arrested on a robbery charge of like $50 or something like that. He has been in prison for 50 years. And so there are all of those people who've been in prison who some people will say, well, he committed the crime, didn't he? So there's another kind of innocence. You know, there's an innocence. I always like to talk about the dialectics of innocence, because we don't want to use innocence in a way that justifies the incarceration of all of those who are putatively not innocent.
Correct.
You see what I'm saying?
Correct.
That is why I think the approach of abolition, the abolition of imprisonment as the dominant mode of punishment, that is the way I think we have to go. We have to be able to imagine and eventually create a social landscape that is not dotted by prisons, and a society that doesn't require prisons in order to produce security. And let me say that, this is the end, because I know you, those of you who are here have been very patient. But let me say that this is not a struggle that is going to be won tomorrow.
No.
And I think oftentimes in this country we have a kind of impatience that we want to see the results immediately, and this is. You know, we want food immediately, so we have fast food. We want, you know, everything has to be
microwave.
Yeah, microwave, and who knows what they're going to discover that those microwaves do to the food that we've been consuming. So I don't, you know, I don't, I don't. I try not to use microwaves. I mean, I try to be vegan. I am vegan. And. But the point that I really wanted to make is that the struggle to undo the effects of racism in this country is going to last a long time. But we have to come face to face with it. We have to recognize that this is not something that's going to happen tomorrow. Racism cannot be eradicated by using the concept of colorblindness and teaching people. I mean, this is what somebody like Gayatri Spivak might call epistemic violence, the violence that you do with the words that you use and with the way you produce knowledge. And that's really a kind of violence to teach people that they're not supposed to notice race, because that means that they're not supposed to be able to see the population that will constitute the majority of people in this country not very long from now. So how do we actually stand up to and recognize the way racism has deformed all of us? And it's not just white people, because black people and other people of color are subject to racist ideology as well. If it's on a dark night and you see somebody walking down the street who looks like he's a young black man with baggy pants, who's gonna walk over to the other side of the street? It's not just white people. So we have a lot of work to do. We have to recreate our institutions. It's not just about attitudes of racism. It's about the structural racism that is entrenched in our major institutions. And so we have to have a kind of patience. So we have to combine patience with an urgency. We have to say, end racism now. Police, we want, as the Black Panther Party said, we want the occupying police force out of our black communities now. We want community control of the police. But I think most important of all, we have to see ourselves as coming together.
Exactly.
A community of resistance, and that will lead us in the direction of freedom and justice and equality.
We are so divided.
Thank you.